From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. If you were reading last night, when you rolled over to turn out the light, what book did you slide onto your nightstand? The Yellow Birds? Canada? Gone Girl? Bring Up the Bodies? Something else? The nights are long now. It's nearly the year's end. Time for sizing up. Recommending. This hour on Point, we're looking at the best books of 2012. You can join the conversation. What book grabbed you this year, wouldn't let you go, took you somewhere that mattered? You can comment at our website, and many have, at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We've got three great readers with us today. Their top picks are up at our website as well. From the Chicago Tribune, literary editor Elizabeth Taylor joins us, former president of the National Book Critics Circle. She's served on three Pulitzer juries, fiction, nonfiction, co-author with Adam Cohen of a book of her own, American Pharaoh, about Chicago Mayor Richard J. Daley. Elizabeth, it's very nice to have you with us.
Great to be with you, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us today. From Oxford, Mississippi, fabled home of William Faulkner, we're joined by Richard Haworth, owner of the nationally renowned, still independent, and quite wonderful bookstore in the center of Oxford, Square Books. Richard, great to have you with us as well.
Thank you, Tom.
So nice to have you. It's great to have you. And finally, from the heart of the American publishing world, New York City, we're joined by Lucas Whitman, books editor for Newsweek and The Daily Beast. Lucas, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Glad to be here.
Hey, Elizabeth, first to you, just kind of broad stroke, what kind of publishing year was this? What did it look like? Does it have a character?
Well, it's not just three shades of gray, I
or
promise
50.
You.
Yeah, okay.
It's not. It's been a great year for fiction, I think, a fantastic year for fiction. A lot of great choices. In my view, not so much on the nonfiction front. I think there have been too many sort of mediocre political books crowding the shelves, books, sort of magazine pieces parading as books. I also think it's the year of the bookstore, independent bookstores are back with a roar. They're just doing great. Square Books, we'll be hearing from there in a moment. Ann Patchett and her new store, it's all really a great mood in the bookstores.
Richard, in Oxford, Mississippi, can you vouch for that? Independent bookstores back with a roar, or just one more piece of roadkill by Amazon?
Well, We're back. I feel like we've always been here, and we're still very much in the game. And roar would be putting it maybe too much for me, but yes, we're here. We're alive and well. Thank you.
Hanging in. I just love your store there in the center of Oxford. Just a wonderful place. I mean, Lucas, look around. Here we were in April. The Pulitzer Prize Board declines to award a prize for fiction this year. Of course, that was off earlier work. And then even before that, Encyclopedia Britannica, talk about big books, saying it'll go all digital. It will stop printing bound volumes. I mean, some people may look around and wonder if the book still has its same iconic power when it's digital. What about that, Lucas?
I feel very strongly it does. I think that we're learning that it doesn't matter what form a book comes in. It's the ideas inside of it. It's the power of the writing and the prose and the poetry, whatever it is. And whether it's downloaded or picked up at a store or bought online or however it is, it's still what's inside that matters, I think.
We've had a lot of these authors with us in this year, Michael Chabon and Gino Diaz and Bring Up the Bodies, Hillary's been with us as well. In September we had Chabon and Diaz and Follett and Zadie Smith all out with novels in a single month. Let's get to these lists. Elizabeth, what's right at the top of yours?
I'm just crazy about a novel called Canada by Richard Ford. It's an amazing novel. I don't know if his name is really familiar to all. He's won a Pulitzer Prize, but I feel like this is just a masterwork.
A lot of talk about Richard Ford in Canada this year. What starts in Montana, you've got trouble in the family, spills over the border. Tell us about it and maybe give us a little read from Richard Ford's Canada, Elizabeth.
Sure. It's in certain ways, it's a coming-of-age story. It's narrated by a kid named Dell, who's 15 years old in Great Falls, Montana. And the language in this novel is just so extraordinary. And that's it's the story itself that's compelling.
His parents rob a bank. That'll make you grow up in a hurry.
Right. And that's life changes in an instant. So let me read you from the beautiful first paragraphs. Mm-hmm. First, I'll tell you about the robbery our parents committed. Then about the murders, which happened later. The robbery is the most important part, since it served to set my and my sister's lives on the course they eventually followed. Nothing would make complete sense without that being told first. Our parents were the least likely two people in the world to rob a bank. They weren't strange people, not obviously criminals. No one would have thought they were destined to end up the way they did. They were just regular. Although, of course, that kind of thinking became null and void the moment they did rob a bank.
Elizabeth Taylor, reading from Richard Ford's Canada, sort of innocence lost and reconciled there. What puts it at the top of your list? I mean, you've given us a great dozen here. What helps it climb all the way to the top of yours, Elizabeth?
I think his exquisite use of language is amazing. And the fact that this is a novel that you can read multiple times and never really get it. And, you know, I read a lot of books, and it's about the third time I read it when I realized that null and void was such a great expression to talk about when you're talking about a bank. There's just so much sort of hidden that this is a novel just to be reread.
Richard Ford in Canada right there. Lucas, take us to the top of your list. We've got some great ones here. But The Yellow Birds had a lot of attention here. Kevin Powers, I think a first-time novelist, and bringing us this Iraq War story and aftermath story. Tell us about it.
Indeed, yeah. He's a first-time novelist, a veteran both of the Iraq War and of the University of Texas at Austin writing programs. He can write, and he's fought. And it's I think, you know, this might be I'm going to go out on a limb here, but this might be the things they carried of the war in Iraq. I think it's a really lyrical, beautifully written book, and it gets right to the heart of what we've all been sort of watching at a distance for the last 12 years, and what some of us have been living on the front lines every day.
I've wanted and wanted to get to it and just haven't managed to get into it yet. Is it more in Iraq or more back in the States after war or both?
It bounces back and forth. It's actually – it's got this kind of slightly fitful quality to it where it's in Germany, it's in Iraq, it's back home in Virginia. It's sort of all over the place. And that sort of I think reflects the feeling that many veterans have of displacement, of not knowing where are we? Where, you know, am I back in Iraq? Am I back home? When I'm home, I think about Iraq. When I'm in Iraq, I think only about home.
Read a little bit, if you would be good at
it. Yeah, this is the very opening of it. The war tried to kill us in the spring. As grass greened the plains of Nineveh and the weather warmed, we patrolled the low-slung hills beyond the cities and towns. We moved over them and through the tall grass on faith, kneading paths into the windswept growth like pioneers. While we slept, the war rubbed its thousand ribs against the ground in prayer. When we pressed onward through exhaustion, its eyes were white and open in the dark. While we ate, the war fasted, fed by its own deprivation. It made love and gave birth and spread through fire.
Wow, it's beautiful writing.
Stunning.
What did you learn about this war, these soldiers in The Yellow Birds?
Well, I think we've all read countless books by wonderful journalists and policy experts and all that about the war. And this is actually the first book that I think really brought me to the heart of the war, to understanding what men like Kevin Powers have gone through, what men and women like Kevin Powers have gone through in the last 12 years. And it also, I think it quite sensibly dodges the kind of shadow of Joseph Heller about, you know, it avoids satire and goes right for our hearts and our emotions about this.
Do you think this is a book, Kevin Powers' The Yellow Birds, that Iraq War vets are going to want to read? Or does it bring it back too vividly? Or I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I'm not sure I can speak for them, but I know I did ask Kevin Powers when I met him about that. And he said that the thing that moved him the most was hearing from veterans and from men he served with, but also others who said that they read it and it spoke to their experience, and they thanked him for that. And so I think that speaks for itself.
Richard, in Oxford, Mississippi, I want to get to your list, but our time is short before the break. Let's hear from a couple of listeners first. Esther in Boxford, Massachusetts. Esther, thanks for calling. What are you reading or finding yourself drawn to this year, Esther?
Hi, Tom. I was calling to talk a little bit about, fatigue because of everything that's been happening in the world around us. I used to read, or I still would like to read, a lot of sort of popular science and military stuff and theology, but this year I have just been exhausted by everything that's happening in the world and the election and our economy. And I think it's come out in my reading choices. I've been reading what I call airport fiction, just sort of, you know, Lee Child, Harlan Coben, George R. R. Martin, just fiction that tells a great story. It entertains me. It takes me away. I don't want to be distracted by deep thoughts. I don't really even want, like, clever turns of phrases. I just want to be entertained.
Just bring you that airport fiction. Richard Haworth in Oxford, are you sympathetic in this year of so much news and politics and all the rest?
Well, I think it's been a good year for both fiction and nonfiction, and I think Elizabeth is right. We did have a, you know, just one book after another of political stuff, left and right and middle and everything, and I think people just got tired of that in the same way they get tired of ads, political ads on TV. Mm-hmm. It just, people sort of faded out on all that, and so I think a lot of people reverted back to other things to read, and I agree with both Lucas's and Elizabeth's choices. I had both of those books, The Yellow Birds and Canada, on my list. I think Canada is perhaps the best book by one of our very best writers. It's interesting that he, at this stage in his career, can come out with a book so powerful and vigorous.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the best books of 2012. Great reads, new insights, old kings, new love, war, journeys. Richard Haworth joins us. He's owner of the nationally renowned Square Books in Oxford, Mississippi. Elizabeth Taylor is with us from Chicago, literary editor at the Chicago Tribune. Lucas Whitman is with us from New York City, books editor for Newsweek and The Daily Beast. Let's get a couple listeners here. San Francisco, California, David is calling. Hi, David. You're on the air. What do you like?
Yo, Tom, the book that really touched me this year was Who Is This Man? The Many Lives of Bob Dylan by David Dalton. And being older than Bob, and way older than David Dalton, I followed, of course, the ups and downs of Bob Dylan from the very beginning. Being an old beatnik myself, the book really touched me, that both of the transformation of America, the transformation of this kid from heavy Minnesota to this guy on endless tour today, seems to be with us forever. I'm talking about Bob Dylan, David Dalton's book, Who Is This Man? The Many Lives of Bob Dylan.
Wonderful. We take the recommendation, David Dalton on Bob Dylan there. And David in San Francisco, thanks. Let me get a couple more. Jane in Braintree, Massachusetts. Jane, what do you like?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Love your program.
Thank you.
It's not my favorite book of the year, but I'm reading No Easy Day by Mark Owen. And
this is about the killing of Osama bin Laden, I think.
Osama bin Laden, yeah. And it frightens me to think that our young people either choose or are exposed to such torturous training of the SEALs. I mean, if one of my sons was a SEAL, I would be so upset. But I just think that we have to look at the extent that we go to beat the enemy at their own game. It's horrifying to me.
No Easy Day by Mark Owen. Get an appreciation of what goes into training the soldiers who were involved in that mission. Jane, I'm glad for your call. Thanks. And let me get one more. Sam in Nashville, Tennessee. Sam, you're on.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
Love your show. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite book this year was Fall of Giants, the Ken Follett, the first of the three trilogy of the that he's expected to write. I think he calls it the Fall of the Century trilogy.
Big name. What's it like? What's the subject of his latest,
Fall of Giants? From about 1890 to the end of World War I. But my question for your guest is, is the history accurate? The stories that he spins of the individuals is what gives it such great meaning, and my family sort of has some of that history tied up in it. But
what's the setting for this one? What country? Where is it? The Fall of Giants?
Well, he parallels like England, Germany, Austria, and Russia, and the United States all at the same time. They're all running concurrently.
And so, the period that he's set it in?
1890 to the end of World War One.
Oh, wow.
With a setting, at the end of the book, you clearly see the clouds on the horizon for the beginning of World War Two.
Right. How much actual history there? Ken Follett's Fall of Giants. He's, of course, a big publishing name and back. I don't know. Elizabeth Taylor, do you know how historically accurate Ken Follett is when he rolls them out?
I don't. I have never subjected it to, a real close
accuracy test.
Study. Yeah. No. But it survives as fiction, I guess. And for me, that's, what makes it a good book.
I mean, you can see in the numbers. He's one of those people that sweeps people away. And then we've got war and Bob Dylan, Lucas. There's a range. Navy SEALs and Bob Dylan. There's a range for you.
Indeed. Well, it just shows you, we all have, I think often with Dylan, it's sort of interesting that he didn't pop up this year, but we had a lot of kind of interesting rock memoirs, Neil Young, Pete Townsend.
Yes.
And it's always interesting to hear these individuals tell their stories as well as reading about them.
Not least because when they write, then they also hit the circuit, so you literally hear them because they're out there talking instead of sitting in the studio. Richard, take us to your top pick, Richard Haworth, there at Square Books.
Okay. I'm not sure it's my top, but one of the books that I've found interesting and fun to recommend to readers this year is a memoir by a woman named Leanne Shapton. It's called Swimming Studies. She trained for the Olympics as a swimmer when she was young. I think she still is fairly young. And the book is really about how much of her life is absorbed with this passion for and this mission to be to excel at swimming. And once that goes away from her, once she's no longer a swimmer, what is replaced in her life that took all that time and energy. And it's a very thoughtful memoir. Susan Cheever said in a review of another memoir earlier this year she said, we're all familiar with the five stages of memoir: myth, trauma, revelation, redemption, and book contract.
Yes.
And this book is refreshing in that it doesn't have that sort of trauma. It doesn't deal with alcoholism and abuse and so forth. But it is still quite dramatic and interesting.
Could you read a little?
Yes, there's a passage here at the beginning. If I think of my dad, he's in our dining room clapping and singing along to The Gambler by Kenny Rogers. The default image I have of myself is a photo, me, 10, standing next to the ladder at Cawthra Park Pool in a blue bathing suit, knees clenched, trying to catch my breath. I've defined myself privately and abstractly by my brief, intense years as an athlete, a swimmer. I practice 5 or 6 hours a day, 6 days a week, eating and sleeping as much as possible in between. Weekends were spent either training or competing. I wasn't the best. I was relatively fast. I trained, ate, traveled, and showered with the best in the country, but wasn't the best. I was pretty good.
Richard Haworth reading there from Leanne Shapton's Swimming Studies. You know, in this year of the Olympics, when we watch those amazing athletes do that swimming, there's something kind of maybe book-like about that activity. A lot more exertion, but they are immersed so many hours a day, literally underwater in those caps and goggles and all the rest, Richard. The life of the mind down there, I have been very curious about when they're doing
exactly.
All that.
She talks a lot about what is on her mind when she's doing these 100 laps in the pool, training, and kind of all these thoughts that are going through her mind. And what happens when she stops swimming is eventually she becomes an artist and obviously a writer. And the book also has some of her artwork in it, so it's an unusual and very interesting book.
Leanne Shapton's Swimming Studies. Elizabeth Taylor in Chicago, take us to the other side of the planet. Catherine Booz had so much attention for her Behind the Beautiful Forever. Is this from a slum in Mumbai that she came to know this New Yorker writer so intimately, so deeply? It makes your list. What puts it there, Elizabeth?
Oh, the word that comes to mind, it's synthesized. she sort of brings it all together, and she's done so much research, but she doesn't sort of show you, I mean, just throw it in your face as a reader. She just, you know, really brings you into the lives of the people. Let me just read. Can I read a bit?
Sure. This is Catherine Booz, Behind the Beautiful Forevers, out of Mumbai in the slum there.
Yeah. Let it keep. The moment when Officer Fishlips met Abdul in the police station. Rewind. See Abdul running backward, away from the station and the airport toward home. See the flames engulfing a disabled woman in a pink flowered tunic shrink to nothing but a matchbook on the floor. See Fatima, minutes earlier, dancing on crutches to a raucous love song, her delicate features unscathed. Keep rewinding back 7 more months and stop in an ordinary day in January 2008. It's about as hopeful a season as there had ever been in the years since a bitty slum popped up in the biggest city of a country that holds 1/3 of the planet's poor, a country dizzy now with development and circulating money.
From Behind the Beautiful Forever, what is the alternate view that Catherine Boo brings us here? India's had so much, you know, up and coming, shining and new India talk in the last half dozen years. It's a little tougher there right now. But what's the view she opens up?
She opens up that this world into this little kind of this 3,000 people huddled together behind the airport. They see the gleaming Hyatts from afar. And they have their own kind of code and rules that kind of keep their community going. And they, you know, their big hope is, you know, trading rubber, trading pipe, little bits of things. One would think it's lawless, but it's really a lot of laws. It's also she also opens up a window into the great corruptness, had the great corruption in India, and of those who are trying to help. The way she does it, she films these kids with her flip phone, and then she shows them the film, and she really sort of it's the culture of empathy that she kind of promotes in her writing.
Amazing intimacy there with a yeah. slum in Mumbai, just behind the airport, where the international traffic comes yeah. in and out. But Catherine Booth takes us. Right there. Lucas, you take us to North Korea with The Orphan Master's Son, Adam Johnson's book, high on your list. What's it about?
I do. It's an amazing book. It's about an orphan in North Korea named Jun Do, and it's his sort of picaresque adventures. He ends up as a fighter in the tunnels between North and South Korea. He learns English and is catching transmissions from Japan. And then he sort of ends up at the end being kind of remade after spending time in a prison of war camp, remade as this great heroic general in North Korea, which of course he's not.
So it's not contemporary then, or is it?
It is contemporary. Sorry, yeah, no, it takes place in sort of a Korea of the last 10 years. During Kim Jong-il is still alive in the book and actually plays a role. And what Johnson has done so brilliantly, and this is Johnson visited North Korea only once for a few days, and otherwise just based this book on interviews with people who escaped, is that he creates this country that none of us know, and that we know very, very little about, and that we can't even imagine sort of living in that kind of world. And he puts us right into the heart of that culture and imagining what it would be like to experience a country which is it's actually kind of it's a fictional country. I mean, it's the only country where fiction is truly alive, and that if tomorrow...
What? Because it's all a propaganda? Is that what you're saying? Simple as that?
Exactly. Exactly. Let's say tomorrow they said Kim Jong-il was actually alive. The rest of the world would say that's impossible. Right. But in North Korea, it would be true.
If the posters go back up, he's alive.
Exactly.
Oh, my gosh. talk about a journey. Talk about a different realm. Let's get to Mary in Buffalo, New York is calling. Mary, you're on the air. What have you loved?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This summer, I read Diana Gabaldon's Outlander series. It's a 7-book series that I believe the first was published in 1991, and each book takes a good 3 to 4 years for her to finish and publish. It's historical fiction and action, adventure, romance with just a drop of time travel.
Okay. And seven of them you read, so you really got committed. That swallowed your summer.
I would finish the seventh book and I'd go back and start the first one over because the characters are so beautifully drawn. Her research is impeccable. Her character development, you literally feel like you're leaving friends behind when you finish the series. Her eighth book is due out next fall to continue the series, and I believe there will be a ninth. She's alluded to the fact that there will be one more book in the series, but completely transported me, and I've read everything I could get my hands on since I was 4 years old.
It sounds like you might have. Diana Gabaldon's The Outlander series. So are you a bookstore buyer, an Amazon buyer? Do you read on a Kindle? How do you do it, all those seven books?
A Kindle. I got a Kindle a couple of years ago for Mother's Day for my kids, and I just inhaled one book after the other. My husband was teasing me that he might have to get a second job to support my habit because I could not read them quickly enough.
Mary, thanks so much for calling from Buffalo. Richard Howarth in Oxford, Mississippi. Do you want to, rent your clothes and scream in the street when people go to the Kindle?
Well, most of the time, of course, I don't know that that's happening or know when it's happening. We do have people who come in the store and you can see them taking notes based on what they see and what's on display and what we're recommending.
Yeah. So you're the tasting counter, not the buying counter in that case.
Yeah, we call it showrooming. But often you can engage those people in conversation with, they understand by coming in here that they value this place, and I think for the most part understand that if they don't support it economically, then it will no longer be here.
But do people come back, Richard, once they go to an e-book? Do they come back to the physical thing? Is it a two-way street or one-way?
A lot of the data on that indicate that yes, people do. I mean, some fairly large percentage of people get them as gifts and actually never use them, and some other percentage, uses them for a while and then stops. But I think most people use both, though obviously there are many people who use the e-reader devices exclusively.
Richard's got all the books you could want. I'm looking on down your list here. You've got One Last Strike by Tony La Russa,
right.
Dear Life, Alice Munro, Orphan Master's Son as Lucas, A Mission from God, James Meredith. Abdul's calling from Bowling Green, Kentucky. Abdul, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This is Abdul calling from Bowling Green. The book I read is As the Shadows Fall. It's written by Mort Shimir.
Yes.
And is a story of young men and young women of Persian heritage in U.S. and brief account of Persian history, past and present, custom, literature, art. And as the story revealed, the reader will learn about the character and secrets, past traumatic lives, and their undiminished love of the country they left behind. Is one of those books that is extremely exciting because every moment you are waiting to read to see what is going to happen, and it's a combination of love, past, present, literature, and I really, really loved it. The way it was really easy to read, and it puts you in a situation as if you are there as you read this story, and it's very exciting. I have been telling all my friends to read this book, and I really, really loved it.
Abdul, we've got it. Maybe useful right now, a kind of bridge between Persia and the United States there, As the Shadows Fall by Mort Shamir. Abdul, we thank you for that recommendation. I appreciate your call from Bowling Green. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the best books of 2012 with Elizabeth Taylor of the Chicago Tribune, Lucas Whitman of Newsweek and the Daily Beast, Richard Howarth. He's owner of the nationally renowned Square Books in Oxford, Mississippi, right in the middle of town there, home to, of course, William Faulkner there, William Morris, John Grisham, and many more over the years, Oxford, Mississippi. Let's go right to our listeners, Brooke in Brookline, Massachusetts. Brooke, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. My book recommendation that I just completed is Sweet Tooth by Ian McEwan.
Yeah. Tell us about it.
It's a somewhat of a spy slash love story, all rolled into one, and there are short stories within because the one of the main protagonists is an author who's been duped by MI5 to write the novels basically that would be against communism. And this is set in the 1970s. It's during the Cold War. The characters are beautifully developed. I think this is a lighter version of a McEwen novel. I think, obviously, Comfort of Strangers is one of his darker books. Solar, his most recent one, is quite hilarious. This one is very autobiographical. I think that probably the character, the male character, male protagonist, the primary protagonist, is probably taken off somewhat of, by McEwen himself. The young woman who is the primary protagonist in the book is beautifully drawn, lovely character. You're left wondering right up into the end. There's a twist ending. It's very readable, and of course, you know, I think McEwen's writing is just as clear and crisp and perfect as one can get in a novel. He uses exactly the right metaphor.
Yeah, Sweet Tooth, Ian McEwen. We have loved talking with Ian McEwen on this show, and I'm glad you raised it. It's on our Lucas's list here. Britain's MI5 intelligence service, recruits a woman who's then funding a young novelist. Lucas Brooke loves it, and it's on your list as well. What about Ian McEwen's outing this year, Sweet Tooth?
Oh, I thought it was terrific. I think it got kind of unfairly drubbed by some critics, but. I think it was a really kind of assured and elegant, and he's such a smooth writer, and it really captured Britain in the 1970s. Britain, sort of gritty and gray, and there's some wonderful sort of appearances by some of McEwen's friends, actually his friends in real life from the 1970s, like Ian Hamilton, a famous literary editor. So I think it's actually in some ways McEwen's maybe his most personal book yet.
We've got Jill writing into us here. She likes Alif the Unseen, graphic novel, really intriguing. Red Shirts by John Scalzi and The Dog Stars by Peter Heller. That's also on your list. Lucas, tell us about The Dog Stars.
This is a book that I just discovered actually just about a few weeks ago, and it's a kind of apocalyptic novel. It's set 9 years after, sort of in the near future, 9 years after some kind of plague has wiped out much of the human population. And we open with this man named Hig and his dog Jasper, and they're kind of camped out in this airfield north of Denver. And every day he goes up and he flies around, and he's a good pilot, and he's got enough fuel left in this airfield to fly for a couple hours every day. And he kind of tours the countryside, and the countryside is empty. Denver has been devastated. And he's there with this one other man, and they have to sort of fight off people who come and try and steal their food. But it's very beautifully written, wonderful descriptions of the kind of wildlife, the natural world. And of course, the natural world is kind of reasserting itself as the human population has disappeared.
Elizabeth, Gino Diaz in our backyard here, you've got his This Is How You Lose Her on your list. Tell us about Gino Diaz coming back. Of course, Oscar Wao made him a big name, and now he's back. What's he bringing us?
Well, he's a MacArthur genius winner, and he shows his genius with this book. It's nine linked stories, and they star you may recall from Oscar Wao.
The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao. There's Junior back again with his what a very original voice, Spanglish and hip hop and all the rest.
Yeah, exactly. And Diaz has a fiercely original voice, and he brings us into the world of Junior, and these story Junior's linked through them all, and he tells these stories about sort of why he craves love. And he's a Lothario. And there's every reason in the world why you would just detest Junior. But Diaz is so empathic. He makes you understand why Junior just craves love.
Tell us about – you're a woman. You're reading about Junior. He's a Lothario. You might be ready to detest him, but you didn't. What is it that he craves that you found – you were relating to, saying, okay.
I just felt he was so kind of needy, and that you kind of understood how he had that he had suffered, and also that his worldview and how he viewed women had been so shaped by his own sort of bad experiences that you could really empathize with the guy.
This Is How You Lose Her by Juno Diaz. Let's get a call from Chicago, your backyard there, Elizabeth. Craig's calling from Chicago. Hi, Craig. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you like?
I like a book. It's called By Men or By the Earth. And I'm kind of a weird call from me because I know the guy who wrote it. But he was an attorney, and then he left the law and walked across the United States.
What's the author's name?
Tyler Colson.
That's a long walk. What does he make of it in the book? What's he bring us about it?
It's a very long book, and he talks about law school and practice of law, and also the day to day, what goes through the mind of a person trying to walk across the country, and it's really fascinating. And I'm in a field related to law too, and right now that industry's kind of imploding.
Yeah.
So it's a really timely piece.
Did it make you want to tie on your hiking shoes and bail out of the career, Craig, and hit the road?
No, not at all. He kind of goes insane a little bit.
You can do that practicing law too, I've heard.
He's better now.
good. Well, our best to your friend Tyler Colson and By Men or By the Earth. Craig in Chicago, thanks for that. Let me get one more. Doug in Westford, Massachusetts. Doug, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I would highly recommend Glittering Images by Camille Paglia.
Yeah.
It's a book of art. It's a series of essays, 30. Her selection of art begins in antiquity and actually ends with George Lucas's The Revenge of the Sith.
Yes.
Her writing is brilliant in its style. It's concise. I read this book like you would read a devotional. Because the pieces are short, I picked it up every day. I read one of the essays. I'm back and forth turning the pages from the work to her description.
Yeah.
Everybody who has read the introduction to this book, when I recommended the book and my friends sat at Barnes & Noble, et cetera, and read the introduction, bought it. Her introduction as to the importance of art and art communicating culture, It's just brilliant.
Doug, I'm right there with you. I admit it. I just love Camille Paglia. This was a lot of fun. We had her on to talk about it. I think it was in October. If you want to dial back on our website, you can go in the archives and hear. She's terrific on art. You know, this is one, Richard Haworth, you know, Camille Paglia's Break, Blow, Burn, her collection of poems and her essays on those famous poems across history. I don't know how many times I've given that as a gift. It's just a perfect thing. Talk about books to go back to. But here she is talking about art across time. Does she have a following in your neck of the woods, Richard?
She does. The University of Mississippi is in our town.
Sure.
So, and she's, I think, fairly widely read among academics, but not strictly, of course. And, yes, quite popular.
Give us something else off your list there, Richard. What's coming up?
I've got a novel, John Saturnall's Feast, by Lawrence Norfolk. He's a British writer. It's book is set in the 17th century England in a village at a time of civil war and religious turmoil. The protagonist is a young boy whose mother has been expelled from the village because she's thought to be a witch. A lot of people have died from a sickness in the village, and they think she's a witch. And so they're expelled and left to their own devices. She has been a cook at one point and teaches her son. She's afraid she's going to die, so she teaches him how to forage and how to prepare recipes and gives him this ancient recipe book, tells him how to find a man who will take him to a manor where he gets on as a kitchen boy and kind of works his way up through the labor system of the manor there, and indeed perhaps eventually into the heart of the manor mistress. So it's a love story, a historical novel. It's published by Grove Press. It's got these two color illustrations and woodcuts throughout the book. So again, this is a book that's beautifully made, beautifully crafted. Something you can't get necessarily on an ebook, and just a great read.
Close to the heart of the bookseller, John Saturnall's Feast by Lawrence Norfolk. Elizabeth, take us to your Gone Girl. Lots of people were reading that last summer. Gillian Flynn's Gone Girl. What about it?
Oh, this is a just a wonderful book. And I personally don't like mysteries. I always end up going to the end and seeing what happens.
She's but in the Ozarks one, here, right? Sort of down and out terrain there.
Right. She caught me right from the beginning. And it's mm-hmm. told in alternating husband-wife chapters. And the wife disappears. There's a little bit of a Huck Finn in there. It's a level about a marriage, but it's also – how they deceive each other and the sort of crazy neurotic interlocking neuroses of this marriage. But it's also about sort of the hollowing out of the Midwest and down and out Ozark America. And it's really – she is such a great storyteller.
Catnip for a lot of people. You've also got Louise Erdrich's latest here. This is a Native American writer, wonderful writer, wonderful guest here on the show. But The Roundhouse is her latest. Tell us about that one.
Yeah. Louise Erdrich, is an astonishing writer. And, she's done these sort of intense kind of family kind of books that are more sort of internal, The Bee Queen, Love Medicine. But this is sort of, I think, most her most politically aware book. And some people say it's her most accessible book, although I find her very accessible. It's basically an Ojibwe woman is raped. And then her husband and son try to seek justice for her. But they run into this big snafu over tribal lands. And where did this rape occur? And it ends up to be this dispute over whether there will be justice and who should bring it. But the characters are fully developed, and the question is who really is a Native American? A one drop of blood kind of thing.
Yeah, an active question in these years. This year, Louise Erdrich's The Roundhouse takes us there into tribal land. Alice Monroe has been a good friend of ours here over the years. She's out with Dear Life this year, Lucas. Tell us about that. It's on your list.
Yeah, these are a collection of short stories. And I think they're Monroe at her kind of sparest and cleanest. And they're all set around the kind of area that's not quite rural, not quite sort of urban in outside of Ontario. And it's just the really stunning, beautiful stories. And her writing is so subtle that sometimes you're reading it and you'll kind of maybe skip a line and you'll realize that in that line some absolutely devastating revelation about the fate of one of the characters has been revealed. You've got to force yourself to slow down and say, oh, wait, you've got to go at her pace. And these stories are also the last four or five of them are quite autobiographical, about a young girl kind of coming to terms with the world and experiencing death when her sort of woman who looks after her dies and sort of getting to know her parents. And I think, these have really come from Monroe's own life.
Alice Monroe delivers in 2012 with Dear Life. Richard Haworth in Oxford, Mississippi, give us one more reading there. You've got the great Wendell Berry as one of many in this book called My Bookstore. And what is it? Some scores of authors writing about their favorite bookstores. Read us a little bit from what Wendell Berry has to say.
Okay. This book, Black Dog and Leventhal, got a lot of different bookstores to suggest writers who would write an essay about their store. And Wendell Berry's piece here goes like this. And so when I'm in Louisville, Kentucky, I like to visit Carmichael's bookstore. Sometimes I go to buy a certain book. Sometimes I go with no purpose, but to see what books there may be there and to visit a little while with the people who work there. The place has the quietness, the friendliness, the smell, and the tangibility that a bookstore ought to have. It is a fair incarnation of the manifold life of books. To go there and find a book I didn't expect or didn't expect to want, to decide I want it, to buy it as a treasure to take home, to conduct the whole transaction in a passage of friendly conversation, that is in every way a pleasure. A part of my economic life thus becomes part of my social life. For that, I need actual people in an actual place in the actual world.
Wendell Berry's contribution to my bookstore, our little bouquet to bookstores right there, read by Richard Haworth. hey, look, you gotta stick up for the beleaguered one here and remember the beauty of that setting. Elizabeth, what do you say? In this, and these are great lists, and listeners, we can't get to all of them. They're all at our website. Check them out. Are you finding people at grips with our time? Authors responding to your thirst, to your readers' thirst with their books this year, Elizabeth?
Yeah, I think that writers are really responding to readers. And I just see time and again that they're just turning out for readers. That there is this sort of longing for connection between reader and writer. And I think that the challenge now is how do we make that happen?
Well, I'm looking right on down these lists, and they're great nonfiction. Lucas, on your list, The Barbarous Years, Every Love Story is a Ghost Story, Far from the Tree. We talked with Andrew Solomon. Wonderful book. Just great, great reading to be done here. We're really grateful to the three of you for taking us into these groves. Elizabeth Taylor at the Chicago Tribune, literary editor there. Sorry we're out of time, but here we are. Elizabeth, thanks so much for joining us from Chicago today.
Thanks so much.
Lucas, it's great to have you. Lucas Whitman with Newsweek and
Thank you.
Daily Beast, all online and wonderful. Lucas, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
And Richard Haworth with Square Books in Oxford, Mississippi. Visit it if you have not. Richard, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Enjoyed it, Tom.
The great jazz man Dave Brubeck is gone. We will listen to his music tomorrow, look back on his life. Join us for that. And thanks for being with us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.